I want to remind you that you're between two Kevins right now, and so just saying Kevin doesn't actually...
Between two Kevins.
Doesn't actually address your speaker.
You are so correct. This is why your value to this podcast is immeasurable. It's for notes like that. So important.
You can use my Hebrew name if you want.
Which is?
Shmuel.
Hello and welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast. It's Sunday afternoon when we're recording this, and this is one of our favorite early season annual traditions known as Small Sample Size Theater. With two of our finest statistical analysis folks, and also just general analysis folks, our West Coast geniuses, our resident West Coast geniuses. Joining us from Seattle is Kevin Pelton, to be known further on this podcast simply as either KP or Pelton. Hello, KP.
I'm used to going by that, so that works.
I know, people, that's it. Or we may call you the machine. Joining us from Los Angeles, further to be known on this podcast as Arnovitz or KA, is Kevin Arnovitz. Hi, Kevin.
Brian, thanks for having me on.
What fantastic foodie meal did you have for dinner last night?
Oh, I was in an NBA arena, Brian. It is pretty bleak. I was at the Clippers Hawks game. So an N/A for last night's food event.
How about this for small sample size theater? Will Paul George continue to average 50 points per 38 minutes? Kevin Arnovitz, yes or no?
Not so long as Kawhi Leonard gets back on the floor. But it has been really impressive. You just forget how multifaceted this guy is. Just he works within offense. He works outside of an offense. He can catch and shoot. He can play pick and roll. Like I'm just actually, it got me really excited. I get to watch a lot of Paul George basketball this season, and I'm very excited about that.
All right. Well, we'll be talking more about that for sure. All right. Our first one we're going to start off with is a Houston Rockets situation. They have played 13 games. Actually, James Harden has played 13 games. I am going to list you the highest scoring seasons in NBA history. Number one, Wilt Chamberlain, 50.4 points. His famous season where he averaged 50.4 points, 1961-62. Highest scoring season ever in terms of point average. Number two, Wilt Chamberlain. 44.8 points the following season, 1962-63. Number three, 39.5 points per game, James Harden, which is what he is doing in the 1920 season so far. And just to put this into perspective, the highest scoring modern era season. So Chamberlain has five of the top six all time, and they're all over 36 points. 36.9 points. Jordan's highest ever was 37.1 back in 86-87 when he was just, before Pippen, when he was just shooting up a storm. He's the only one to crack Wilt Chamberlain in that list. The highest Harden has ever had was last season where he averaged 36.1 points. That got him seventh all time. So just a hair, about a point a game behind Jordan's best ever season. Kevin Pelton, can James Harden, he's not obviously catching Chamberlain's top two, I don't think, but can James Harden become just the second player in history to average 40 points a game in a season?
He can. I'm not sure I would bet on that. I would bet on him having the highest scoring season since Chamberlain and beating out that Jordan because, you know, you look at his stats and it's not a lot of small sample size theater at all, really. The biggest difference from last season, the reason for his scoring increase, he's playing the same number of minutes per game. He's scoring pretty much the identical number of points per 100 possessions. It's up from 48.2 to 48.5 with last night's effort. But the difference is almost entirely that Houston has gone from one of the slowest paced teams in the league to now the fourth fastest pace entering last night's game. And that's something that tends to stabilize at the team level pretty quickly, kind of the stylistic markers of how you play tend to stabilize more quickly than the results, the outcome based. So, you know, I think pace will come down over the course of the season. We do traditionally see that, but we're probably going to see Harden shoot better from on threes than he has this year, where, you know, he's at 33% so far, which would be the lowest mark of his NBA career. So I don't think we're going to see a big decline in his points per game.
To follow Kevin's point, what's really interesting here is, generally speaking, one of the features of small sample size theater in November is when Brian asks a question of, hey, can this guy keep it up? It's because they've been overperforming or gotten a little lucky or been way outside from a positive outlier standpoint. But that's the thing, right? Like, he's not even shooting all that well. I mean, imagine if he becomes a little more proficient, like, per possession. The usage, Pelton, has anybody ever had a usage of over 40?
Oh, I guess maybe you're looking at slightly different ones, because on Basketball Reference, I believe he's been over each of the last 2 years.
Yeah, I'm on the NBA one, but I mean, he is like so far ahead of the next, like Kawhi is second among players at 35.7, and then it's like Giannis and Trey, exactly who you would imagine. But the margin is so insane, and I mean, that's what's so strange. Like, usually in this exercise, if somebody is putting up boffo numbers that seem completely out of whack with historical precedents, it's because, oh, well, this guy's not going to, you know, Aaron Baines is not going to continue to shoot 50% from three, whatever the thing is. And with Harden, he's not even been that efficient. I mean, that's what's crazy about it.
Yeah, and as Pelton mentioned, he is shooting, I think, the lowest percentage of his career, under 42%. It's not vastly off of last year's numbers. He shot 44% last year, but the volume that he shoots at, which this season he's taking a career-high 26 field goals a game, 15 of them three-pointers, 2 percentage points could make a pretty big difference. The other thing I'll point out is he's not quite on pace to do it, but he's in, you know, it depends on how many games he might miss. Last year he played 78 games. Let's just say he plays 78 games again this year. His current pace is to kind of be about 15 three-pointers behind Steph Curry for the all-time record for most threes in a season, which was 402. He's on pace right now for 384, assuming that he plays 78 games. If he plays more games than he did last year, he could break that record. He's also on pace for one of the highest free throw seasons in the modern era. Now, free throws are a lot different than they used to be. You know, Chamberlain led all. I think the highest number, I think even with all the high free throw seasons that Harden has had, and his all-time most that he had was, I think, 3 years ago when he averaged, I think it was maybe 12 a game. That was only 24th all-time. The modern player with the most free throws ever was Dwight Howard in the 2010-11 season. Other than that, you're going back to Chamberlain. But he certainly could end up with the most free throws ever in the modern era, because he is averaging 15 free throws a game, which is 4 more than he averaged last year, which was his career high. So, you know, that alone right there, just the extra 2 trips to the free throw line a game, the extra 2 shoot the fouls that he's drawing a game, is enough to potentially push him to these limits. And this was not something that, you know, I think people thought he may score a little bit more this year, but this is, again, historic level season. And any non-Will, if you're not named Will Chamberlain and you're being compared to Will Chamberlain, as I've said before, it's pretty remarkable.
I mean, I think people kind of expected him to score less this season with Westbrook's arrival. And the fascinating thing is Westbrook's usage rate is the same as it was last year. Partially the decline of Eric Gordon and now his knee surgery has created more opportunities to go around. And then also Tyson Chandler sporting like the lowest usage rate basically we've ever seen on record since he's stepped into the starting lineup temporarily in place of Clint Capella. But, you know, those two guys have both been able to keep that up well, you know, not well playing together, which is fairly shocking.
That's the Harden one. Now let's go to another one that we're talking about a future Hall of Famer here, but not something he's ever done before, and that is LeBron James leading the league in assists, as he is right now at 11.1 assists per game. Now, we're recording this before the Lakers play the Hawks on Sunday night, but considering the Hawks gave up 150 to the Clippers last night, I don't know, maybe LeBron's assists will not go down, so he may even pad that total. To give you an idea, the highest assist total, the average of LeBron's career, is 2 assists less than this a game at 9.1. That was his last year in Cleveland. That was one of his most incredible seasons of all time. He led the league in minutes that year, played all 82 games, averaged 9.1 assists. But he's never even averaged double-digit assists, and I don't think he's even ever been in the top 3 in average assists per game. Kevin Arnovitz, he's averaging 3 points less a game this season than he did last year. He's averaging 24 points a game. If he were to average 24 points a game, if he were to finish the season at that, it would be his lowest scoring average since his rookie season when he averaged 21. He's taking about the same amount of shots, one shot less per game. But it's very clear over his first dozen games that he is very much focused on being a setup man for Anthony Davis. I don't have the numbers updated, but when I did a piece on LeBron's passing to Anthony Davis this last week, in their first 9 games together, he had assisted Anthony Davis 26 times. To compare that to his first 9 games with Dwayne Wade, he assisted Dwayne Wade, his peanut butter and jelly guy, just 13 times, half of that. And his first 9 games with Kyrie Irving, he assisted him 9 times. So he is very invested, obviously, in getting him going. So Kevin Arnovitz, do you think LeBron can lead the NBA in assists this season?
Yeah, I think he can, provided a couple of caveats. I mean, so much of this is the answer to that question is, well, how is he going to function in the Lakers' offense? And, you know, there are a couple of things that are working in his favor in terms of if the goal here is, hey, let's lead the league in assists. I mean, one is, you know, the other night when Avery Bradley, you know, is now out with a hairline fracture in his leg, the Lakers roll out a lineup of Danny Green, who, by the way, has never dribbled a basketball, which is an unknown fact. Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, another guy who's not necessarily kind of a ball handler. So long as LeBron continues to function as the point guard in that offense, the answer is unquestionably, provided that Anthony Davis remains healthy, right? I mean, you need, if you're going to lead the league in assists as LeBron James on the 2019-20 Lakers, you know, obviously you need to have a recipient like Davis. So as long as he's on the court, I mean, that is magic. So long as he is on the court functionally as the point guard, you know, Rondo's return is interesting because Rondo is, I wouldn't call him a pure point guard, but as close to a distributor first guard as there is in the league. And he's just come back. So I'm curious to see when LeBron cohabitates the floor with Rondo, does he move back into a functionally a non-point guard role? But I think, I mean, with Bradley out, with Davis in, with if Caldwell Pope and Green are going to be your two other perimeter teammates, neither of whom is by any stretch a distributor point guard playmaker in that respect. I mean, particularly not Green. The conditions are there. That is a lot of perfect storm to do it.
I think Kevin hit on the key points there. I mean, LeBron is converting potential assists a little more frequently. If you look at those numbers, which Second Spectrum tracks and are available on NBA Advanced Stats, it's 56% of his potential assists have been converted this year compared to 50% last year. But that's pretty reasonable when you consider how much the roster around him has improved with, you know, Davis in particular. I agree that Rondo's return is the big question. Last year, you know, LeBron averaged 11.6 assists per 100 possessions when Rondo was on the bench and only 8.6 when they played together. So you also see Caruso this year when those two guys have shared the court that LeBron's assists per 100 are down a couple possessions per 100. So, or a couple assists per 100. So it's really mostly, I think, a question of whether he continues to play point guard for this team.
By the way, I'm a little bit worried about Anthony Davis with that shoulder injury. Those types of shoulder injuries, they linger for a while. And same with Kyrie Irving. You know, it's not as serious as somebody who needs to go have surgery. But it's, both of those guys are worrisome. So I don't know if Anthony Davis, we'll see how he's able to carry the load. But the Lakers, in general, have been terrific at sharing the ball. They're again, this is going into Sunday night's game. They're fourth in the league in average assists per game. I think we thought that their offense would be pretty potent with those two guys, but they're getting tremendous offensive output. I'm a little bit concerned about their 3-point percentage. They are not hitting the amount of threes that I think a team at that level needs to do in the long run. In fact, I talked with some Laker officials about this last week when I was at one of their games. They said that they feel like they're getting quality shots. They just don't, to some of their guys that they're expecting to hit threes are just not making them. But that's something to work out. But as far as actually assisting, their offense is functioning at a very high level. But not as high of a level as their defense. Yeah, go ahead, Kevin.
To me, Brian, like, that's been one of the great surprises. I just thought it would be a more provisional offense. I thought it would look more like a Cleveland, you know, during the championship run. And this has been a more orderly offense. I mean, it has form. I think part of it is, obviously, you know, again, Davis is one of the most imposing role men in the league. You have a guy, like, it's amazing what Danny Green can do in an offense. You know, you can run structure. It's kind of like a J.J. Redick offense, a Ray Allen offense, Danny Green. So there are a couple of guys in the league who, by virtue of what they do, sort of can provide structure to an offense and make it less provisional. And I think all of these facets that I at least I didn't consider as readily as I probably should have lent it this, it looks like an offense. I mean, it looks like, I wouldn't say it's systematic, but it has qualities of a system, and right, which is why they're ranked sixth in assist rate as a team. And it's not something I was expecting. I just have come to assume that a LeBron team is going to be, they're going to get the job done. It's going to be a high potent offense, but it'll be a lot of ISOs. It'll be, you know, kind of opportunistic mismatch exploitation and all that stuff. But it has looked like an offense. I mean, they've been one of my favorite teams to watch so far, and it's been really good to look at.
Hello. No one is available to take your call.
So the other day I was in the makeup chair before going on the jump. That's right. I wear makeup. I don't have perfect skin. And the fantastic makeup artist had to work a little hard because I had nicked myself shaving. And I nicked myself shaving because I was using a dull blade. And I was using a dull blade because I hadn't replaced it because it's really expensive and I didn't feel like paying like $35 to get a month's worth of blades. And I shame on myself because I have a better option, which is the Dollar Shave Club. And I've used the Dollar Shave Club before and I'm back on the wagon because not only are they affordable, but the quality of their products is top notch. They've spent years developing, crafting, refining all that stuff. And they've got everything you need to look, feel, and smell your best. Not just razors, but those are what their bread and butter is. You name it, they have it. And you can use it to look and feel fantastic. As I said, they're more than just razors. They've got everything you need to shower, shave, style your hair, brush your teeth, and yes, even clean yourself in other areas. Can I say that diplomatically? One of the cool things about them is they can keep you automatically stocked up on the products that you use. When you get signed up, they can send it to you once a month or a few times a year. You don't have to waste time at a store wondering what's good or if it's any good. When you become a Dollar Shave Club member, you know what you're going to get, and you know it's going to be of the highest quality. And right now, you can put that to the test. Their Ultimate Shave Starter Set has basically everything you need for an amazing shave. The Executive Razor, Shave Butter, Prep Scrub, and Post Shave Do. That's what I really needed the other day. The best part is you can try it for just $5. After that, the restock box ships and regular size products at regular prices. You can get your ultimate starter set for just $5 at dollarshaveclub.com/hoop. That's dollarshaveclub.com/hoop. H-O-O-P. Dollar Shave Club.
Hello. No one is available to take your call.
Speaking of their offense, it's their second most impressive unit so far. So this is our next big question. This is, again, going into Sunday night. This podcast is scheduled to post on Monday, so I suppose the Hawks could put up a big number on them and they could slip to number two. But as of right now, according to NBA.com, the Lakers are the number one defense on the team. Defensive rating, which is the points you allow per 100 possessions, is number one, 99.8. Less than a point per possession for the Lakers. They're the only team in the league that can say that. The Jazz are right exactly at 1 point per possession. Allowed. So the Lakers are not that far ahead. This is not something that I expected. LeBron's defense last year was morbid. You know, Kuzma has not proven to be a great defensive player. The guys that they added, some of them really did look like, you know, good defensive additions. Danny Green, Avery Bradley, although Avery Bradley's individual stats on defense have eroded over the years. Believe it or not, guys, I honestly think that Dwight Howard has played a big role here. The Lakers have elected to pretty much play the entire game with a traditional center, with your JaVale McGee or Dwight Howard. There's some periods of the games where they play with a power forward playing center, but that often is a guy named Anthony Davis, who is leading the league in blocks right now. So they have one of the most effective rim-protecting defenses in the league, and they're the way that they play, they do not do a lot of switching. They sort of pressure the perimeter and sort of invite the players to drive into the basket defenders. It doesn't always look like that, but in general, that's what they try to accomplish. And LeBron's been showing much improved defensive effort. And here we have the number one defense in the league, Kevin Pelton. Can the Lakers, I mean, number one, I think is really ridiculous, but can the Lakers even remain a top 3-4 defense for the course of this season?
I think maybe. I mean, they have definitely benefited in terms of opponent shooting so far. You know, we talked earlier about how the style of play, and this is where the shots are coming from in this case, tends to stabilize more quickly than, you know, the outcome of those shots. Their shot profile, if you look on seconds, based on the second spectrum data, it's only slightly better than average based on the location of that shot, the type of shot, and then how close the nearest defender is from the Lakers. But the opponents then, if you compare that to how well they've actually shot, it is the third worst shot making, of any set of opponents in the league so far this season. Particularly that's been true from the 3-point line. Opponents are making 32% of their threes, which ranks 26th of the 30 teams. So, well, I think the Lakers are probably going to shoot better on threes than they have so far. Their opponents probably are too. And, you know, given that that's the strongest component of their defense so far is their shot defense, they've been good on the defensive glass, good at forcing turnovers, but it's really the shot defense that's driving this. So I think they will slip a little bit there, but, you know, maybe still, possibly still a top five defense, I think.
Yeah, Pelton, my number one, Pelton kind of stole my thunder here in the sense that my number one reference for, hey, is this real, is I go to, quantified shot probability or quantified shot quality, both of those metrics on second spectrum, which is, hey, like, if left to their own devices, how good a shot is this if it's made at an average pace and at an average rate? And the answer is the Lakers are 11th in yielding shot quality and fifth, in shot probability, which I trust a little bit more just because it also accounts for who's taking the shot. Obviously, you leave certain guys open in a way that you don't leave other guys open. And they're fifth. So I think, are they the number one defensive team by the end of the season? Probably not. Also, keep in mind that, you know, LeBron at a certain point will want to pace himself, as will Davis or anybody else. But I do think that, look, they have really good personnel. I think we forget that Anthony Davis is a top five individual defender in this league. He's really versatile. Danny Green is the best defensive transition wing in the league, and that's gonna give you a couple possessions of defense a game to help the margin. They just have a lot of guys who can do this individually, and they have some good size, and they have some flexibility, and I just think those are things you want. I don't see them finishing top one, but I think they could very easily finish in the 4, 5, 6, 7 range. You know, if they maintain their intensity on this thing, they just have the personnel to do it.
You know, they have also benefited from a somewhat easy schedule so far. They have played the 19th toughest or 11th easiest schedule to this point based on Jeff Sagarin's ratings. Now, look, that, you know, we're not talking about, you know, that big of it's. I don't want to dedicate just a schedule, but they have played somewhat of a favorable schedule, and their schedule remains favorable really through the end of the month. So let me just go over, you know, they play the Hawks, as I mentioned, tonight. You'll already know what happened in that game by the time you listen to this. And they play a home and home with the Thunder. Then they play the Grizzlies, who are not a pushover, and the Spurs and the Pelicans, and then the Wizards. Now that finishes out the month. One of the reasons why their record is so good is because they've played a softer schedule. However, They've been winning those games, which is what you need to do. When you are around the Lakers, you talk to some of their coaches or some of their players or at their front office, as I have over the last week, they talk about December. The Lakers' December is really challenging. Right in the first week alone, they play Dallas, Denver, and Utah 1-2-3 out of the gate. Later in the month, they have a road trip to Indiana and Milwaukee, and then they play the Nuggets and Clippers back to back, and that's before you even get to the New Year. So, and then of course they have the Clippers game is on Christmas Day. So the Lakers, I feel like we will know more about the Lakers in a month from now, especially. Leading the league in defense is the Lakers, as we mentioned. Leading the league in offense, the Boston Celtics, scoring about 113 points per 100 possessions. They lost one of the best players in the league in Kyrie Irving, an all-NBA player who went elsewhere. They lost Gordon Hayward to a severe injury. They keep chugging along. They have the best record in the NBA. Ahead of they're ahead of the Mavericks, who, by the way, are a nice surprise. Their potency on offense, and the Rockets are third, and then another surprise, the Washington Wizards fourth. But Kevin Arnovitz, can the Boston Celtics and their sort of democratic, I guess is one way to put it, or equal opportunity scoring offense that's focusing on putting small guys on the floor who can all shoot and shoot threes at a high volume. Can they maintain this small sample size of being the number one offense in the league?
Our friend David Thorpe had a wonderful post with True Hoop, kind of really just delineating all the different ways that the Celtics are succeeding offensively right now. I mean, obviously, it starts with Kemba Walker, which he's been one of the more prolific pick-and-roll practitioners in the league for years now. I mean, he's gotten so good at it. He's not a big guy, and just the art of deception with the dribble, with his movement, he's kind of, he's really patient, he changes speeds. But one of the things that David Thorpe, so kind of delineated was just how many different ways they're doing this. They're also playing Kemba off the ball really well. The way that they're maximizing Jason Tatum's speed, both in the full court and the half court. They have a lot of guys who can initiate offense, and it is tempting to kind of run a very rote pick and roll system with Kemba, but they've really varied it, and everyone is just, is engaged. They're so athletic. I mean, that's the thing. You don't think of the Celtics in those terms. It's not maybe it's something we've never thought of the Celtics, even in terms of history, as a team that has always put a premium on athleticism, but you just kind of look at those rangy wings like Brown and Tatum, and it's just working really well, and it's been far more aesthetically pleasing to watch than I thought it would be. It's not that I don't enjoy watching Kemba play pick and roll 48 possessions a game, but they've just been doing so much more than that, and they're kind of using those sort of, Stevens is so good at just one wrinkle of misdirection here, one wrinkle of misdirection there, and I don't know that they'll finish number one. There's so many prolific teams. I'm curious to see what the Clippers look like when both Leonard and George get on the floor. But I think what my assumption that they would be an upper middle of the pack offensive team was clearly too low of an expectation. They know how to get shots, and I don't think that's going to change.
I mean, we talked earlier about, the number one thing you look at is shot making in terms of whether a team can keep this up. And if you look at that on second spectrum from the Celtics, their shot making has actually been a little worse than average so far this season. They've gotten high quality shots this year. And then the thing that has really driven their offense much more so than their shot making has been their ability to take care of the basketball. They're, kind of middle of the pack and 12th in terms of effective field goal percentage on offense, but they are number one in turnover percentage, and they are number one by a wide margin. The gap between them and the number two team, which is Orlando, is larger than the gap between Orlando and the 11th team in the league. So, they're just never turning it over, and that's maybe a quality we don't think about that much is associated with elite offenses. We think much more about shot making, but, if you get attempts at the basket, that's going to help your chances. One thing we haven't talked about yet is, you know, Gordon Hayward's injury is going to affect them over this next 6 weeks here that he's sidelined. He has 5 weeks at this point since he's already been out a week. And then they also have benefited from schedule, according to Basketball Reference's metric, you know, their simple rating system. They have played the easiest schedule in the league thus far. So that's going to get a bit more challenging as they continue out on this West Coast road trip. You know, they started the other night against the Warriors, but, you know, I think same thing with the Lakers, probably not the number one offense in the league, but probably better than we expected and somewhere in the top five.
Yeah, the Sagarin ratings had them with the third easiest. I was laughing this week. You remember last season when the Celtics got off to a rough start and they made that flight out to played the Warriors. I think it was also on a weekend and they beat the Warriors and everybody was like, "Oh, we had this great flight. We played poker as a team or Bure, whatever they played, and we just had this great 6-hour flight and everything's going to be A-okay." And they had a pretty good West road trip, and then it wasn't A-okay. They took the flight this year and pounded the Warriors, and they took the flight with the best record. So, it's easy to remember, that just when you think you have things figured out, you can go sideways. But yeah, I expect them to come back to the pack a little bit. The real question to me is whether or not they can get away with playing defense. Marcus Smart is, astonishing everybody with the way he's shutting down power forwards, but I don't know if that's feasible for big chunks of games over the course, of the season. So Kevin Arnovitz, one of the things that you talked about that you were surprised and wanted to investigate was a couple of starting units that have really performed better than we could ever have dreamed. And that is the Cleveland Cavaliers and Phoenix Suns. Two of the best starting groups in the league. And the Suns starters, not what they expected because DeAndre Ayton has been out and has been replaced in the starting lineup by Aaron Baines, who has performed extremely well, shooting the ball brilliantly. And the Cavs are, have been playing with really young guards. I wasn't sure they were actually going to start Garland and Sexton, but they have. And Tristan Thompson and Kevin Love are also playing very well. Kevin Arnovitz, I don't have the updated numbers in front of me. Maybe you do. Kevin Arnovitz, can the Suns and the Cavs continue to play at this level with their starters?
I mean, what's so fascinating is with Phoenix's offense. I mean, that starting unit is 121.5 points per 100 possessions. And, you know, it's so funny because I don't want to find false trends. Like, there's so much confirmation bias you can do here. Like, well, of course they got a true point guard and let Devin Booker just being a scoring wing that he is, right? Like, that's easy to say. And, but it is sort of food for thought, though. I mean, having a guy like Rubio, who, by the way, you know, doesn't have much range himself, has amazing vision, but is not someone who has typically been associated with the highest octane offenses, and that's been an interesting thing to see. Saric kind of replacing that the constant carousel of power forwards they've had there in past years, trying to I call them stretch threes. You're trying to disguise them as fours. And now you have a guy like Saric who's almost tailor-made for that position, who, again, hasn't, I don't think himself been overly prolific, but there's just some form and order to the offense. I mean, on the instances I've watched, I mean, Oubre's overperformed. I've never been a huge Kelly Oubre guy, but there's just, he's overachieved. And obviously Baines has been just an incredibly, outlier in terms of offensive individual performance.
Baines shooting 47% on three-pointers.
Right. So that's not going to last. Yeah. I mean, this is not a team that's going to score 121.5 points per 100 possessions. I think we can all safely say that. But they've just been more orderly, and I don't want to give too much of the credit to Rubio, because I think Rubio's been fine. But there is something about it that looks systematized. I mean, Monty Williams is a guy who tends to have a thicker, kind of more staged offense than has typically been the custom in Phoenix in the last decade. And, I'm not somebody who feels like you need to have a coach commandeering or you necessarily need to do that. I mean, there are teams that do beautiful jobs improvisationally, provisionally with offense, but I just think that it looks like a product that's like, oh, okay, I know what they're trying to accomplish here. I mean, I see Ricky operating the pick and roll. Like, I see, like, they get the shot to Booker at the right moment in the right spot. And he is so good at just sort of carving out just enough space to do what he needs to do, either as a jump shooter, either as a driver. And I think everyone has been maximized in that offense thus far. And again, it looks better than it is because Baines is overperforming. And I think, you know, Oubre might come back to earth a little bit, but it's just, I mean, you don't generate a true shooting percentage of 63.5% as a unit just getting lucky.
That's amazing.
There's some pace there. There's some order. They know what they come down and actually know what they want. Guys aren't sort of, I haven't seen a trace of selfishness in the system. And given the personnel, it could very easily play that way. Cleveland, I've watched a little less, to be honest, but that defensive number is interesting. But you and I were talking about this the other night at the game. Like, you know, you forget Kevin Love and Tristan Thompson. That is a front court of competent veteran players who have their virtues and kind of complement each other. You do that with just a Sexton is really good at breaking down defenses. He's still immature. There's still kind of there are moments where it's not completely premeditated and you know it's going to get better. It's not at the point where there's always method to the madness, but there's method there, and it's just it's competent. Like that's a competent basketball unit.
Sexton had a very good last third of the season last year. He did not start off that well. By that point, everybody had kind of, you remember the Cavs sort of thought they were going to be a playoff team or a contender last year. They punted on that and fired Ty Lue shortly into the season, went into, you know, tank mode. They would never say that, but that's what they were doing. And Sexton actually finished pretty well. I don't think he got noticed, and the Cavs were very disappointed that he didn't get voted in an all-rookie team. But he did shoot over 40% from three-point range as a rookie.
But he just wants to eviscerate you. I mean,
he's got a lot of vision. He's got a lot of drive for sure.
Yeah, like it's an intimidating and confrontational brand of point guarding, and it's just it works. I mean, defensively, I don't have an explanation for it. Pelton, I mean, 98.4 per 100 on this unit. I mean, is that what am I seeing? What am I not seeing?
Yeah, I mean, 31% opponent 3-point shooting in that group. I don't think that's probably going to last in that one. You know, an experienced, successful front court in Love and Thompson. But even when the Cavs were really good, you didn't think of it as because of, you know, their front court defense was the reason for it. Thompson gives you a degree of versatility, and his transformation has been quite fascinating this season. This looks like maybe one of the great career years of all time so far from Tristan Thompson, where he's back averaging a double-double after really being an afterthought, much like the Cavs in general last year.
The most field goal attempts Tristan has ever averaged in his career was 9 a game, and that was in the pre-LeBron Cavs, where they just didn't have much. He's leading the Cavs in field goal attempts this year, 12 plus a game, essentially tied with Kevin Love. Him being a focal point of the offense, that's pretty surprising. You know, like I said, Darius Garland is not off to a great start. He's only shooting 33% overall. But
Sexton start from last year.
Yeah. And I said it on the podcast last week. I'll say it again. The Cavs fans love their nickname for their new backcourt, Sexland. Cleveland Sexland. All right, so we'll see. I think the Suns – I see the Suns legitimately fighting for a playoff spot. You know, if the season were to end today – let me see – the Cavs had a really poor performance against a team we're going to talk about next, the other night against the Heat. But the Cavs were heading into the weekend. I think they were in sort of playoff position. I think it's more likely the Suns figure out a way to make it than the Cavs do. But nonetheless, we're, you know, about what, at eighth into the season, and well, the Cavs are in 10th. So they were in 8th the other night.
Hello, no one is available to take your call.
You know, on this podcast, we love talking basketball. We get around with the guys or the girls, and it's one of our favorite things to do. We love doing it. We want to keep doing it for a long time. What we don't like talking about that isn't easy is erectile dysfunction. Usually people just brush it off, they blame themselves, or they altogether ignore it. But with Roman, it's easy to talk about it. With a real doctor that can prescribe real medication, it's safe, simple, and totally discreet. With Roman, you can get a free online evaluation and ongoing care for ED, all from the comfort and privacy of your home. The doctor will work with you and find the best treatment plan. And if medication is appropriate, Roman will ship it to you with free two-day shipping. The whole process is straightforward, simple, and discreet. Getting started is simple. You just go to GetRoman.com/hoop and you complete an online visit. Erectile dysfunction used to be tough to tackle, but now there's Roman. So you can complete an online visit today to connect with a doctor and just get it taken care of and move on with your life. So go to GetRoman.com/hoop for a free online visit and then free two-day shipping. That's GetRoman.com/hoop for a free visit to get started. GetRoman.com/hoop.
Hello, no one is available to take your call.
The team with the second best record in the East, we talked about the Celtics, they're 10-1 coming into tonight. And they've already gone on a West Coast trip. Their schedule has been more demanding. Are the Miami Heat, who have faced all kinds of internal strife with a couple of players being suspended, or if not suspended, sent away from the team because they weren't, you know, meeting standards, which happened with James Johnson. Deion Waiters has been suspended two different times. Kelly Olynyk missed almost the entire training camp due to an injury he suffered over the summer. Jimmy Butler missed three games, his first three games, because of the birth of a child. They're relying on rookie guards to play, in important minutes. And here they are, Kevin Pelton. 9-3, second best record in the East. This is a team that has sort of been just hovering around 500 for the last three seasons. They've had spurts of good runs, famously a couple years ago when they went, you know, like 30-11 in the second half and then spent hundreds of millions on that team. They are always dangerous because Eric Spoelstra is a good coach, and typically Spoelstra gets more out of them than meets the eye. But Kevin Pelton, can the Miami Heat remain one of the Eastern Conference's better or best teams?
I would say probably not. This does seem like the team that is the classic ripe for regression team early in the season. If you look at it offensively, they have the second best shot making so far, which in a combination with, you know, above average shot quality has resulted in, you know, essentially a tie with Phoenix for the best effective field goal percentage in the league. Defensively, slightly below average shot quality, and they're sixth in terms of lowest opponent shot making. So, you know, kind of both of those, you're in the wrong direction of where you'd want to be if you're looking forward, that they've benefited from poor shot making by their opponents, great shot making themselves. I think their defense is really kind of fascinating though, because, you know, they're not necessarily great in terms of opponent shooting thus far. They've relied defensively on forcing turnovers. They're number two in opponent turnover rate. The kind of flip side of that is they've given up a ton of three-pointers, the most in the league on a rate basis per shot attempt. And, you know, opponents haven't shot those particularly well so far. I think they probably will. And that's one of those things I think does tend to catch up with you. I also think offensively, you know, Kendrick Nunn, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, the role of the domestic incident he had while he was in college and his going undrafted and then spending last year in the G League, which I think is important context, but, you know, it also can make him seem like a better prospect than he was. It's not like he was a great G League player. He shot 33.5% on threes last year in the G League and is shooting 38% so far in the NBA, which suffice it to say is not how that's supposed to work when you go up from the G League to the NBA. So, you know, I think now having said all that, they've been so good so far. They've played a very difficult schedule. There's room for them to regress and still be, you know, probably the fourth best team in the East, depending on how, you know, things shake out with Indiana once they get Victor Oladipo back. We'll see with Toronto. But I think it's very possible that they could be a top four team, could host a first round series in the East, but I don't think they're going to stay up there, you know, along with Philadelphia and Milwaukee and ahead of those two teams.
I also didn't mention before you go, Arnovitz, I didn't mention that, they've only had Justice Winslow, who they were counting on to play a really kind of a big role operating their offense. They've only had him for five games so far. He's nasty. Well, I don't know if it was nasty because they didn't initially think it was a concussion, but he ran into Paul Millsap. God, I think it's been over a week ago, and they listed him as out with a headache, and then he entered the concussion protocol later. By the way, there was a... There was an injury report one day when the when the Heat were in Phoenix, like a week and a half ago, where they listed as Justice Winslow out with a headache, Deion Waiters and James Johnson out with stomach aches. And that was the night Deion took the edible. But that headache turned out to be a concussion, and he has been out for quite a while because of it. So Arnovitz, I was mentioning all the issues they had with missing players. I forgot about Winslow as well.
Yeah, I mean, my head is with Pelton in the sense that if ever you're looking for outliers and you're playing small sample size theater, you go to all the things we look at, which is, hey, how are they actually in terms of shot quality? What are they yielding? And what are the prevailing trends here? And it all suggests they will fall back to the pack behind teams that have more raw talent than they do. I just so enjoyed kind of watching it happen. I actually think the defense can get better. I mean, it's ranked, I think, third, to Kevin's point. If you look at it through shots yielded, they are sort of there. It is a heavy pressure. They leverage and gamble a fair amount in terms of kind of lending help. But I also think there are nights where I've watched them, and it looks like what Eric Spoelstra is fond of saying, everybody on a string. It's that kind of defense where they just don't make a ton of mistakes. I have fallen in love with the games of Bam Adebayo, and just I had no idea he had playmaking skills.
He is having a great season. Season.
They just have a lot of competent, overachieving basketball players, which makes it very tempting to kind of root for them. I mean, I've enjoyed watching Nunn and Duncan Robinson, who just that guy just is a gunner, and it's working. Is he going to continue to shoot 40.6% from three? I don't know. Is that a candidate for regression, especially when defenses realize they actually now need to kind of account for him? Probably. I am also actually curious to see how it works with Winslow, who's such a unique player in the sense that he has, you know, he has some pronounced weaknesses. He has some pronounced strengths. He's really tough. He is in many ways very Heat-ish in profile. But I still kind of, they're now my favorite as the, you know, they in Toronto, Indiana's still there and has played better. But, if you're asking me who's the four seed, I do feel like I'm confident that Milwaukee, Philly, and Boston are probably a bit better than the rest of the pack, but I see Miami now as a four team that I don't want to see in a second round series because I do think they can. I think they come prepared and defensively, or they take risks, but it works. They have great ball pressure, and Jimmy is just he's a fish in water right now. As I said, I think on an episode of The Jump, if you had given Jimmy Butler a BuzzFeed quiz, which NBA team are you? Culturally, in terms of sensibility, in terms of habit, in terms of temperament. You know, if you'd given that to him at any point in his career, it would have come back Miami Heat. And I think there's something to be said for a top-line player who is comfortable in his environment, has a sense of ownership and accountability about the team, is playing in an organization whose best practices are top notch. I just think that there's something going on there that's positive, and I don't think I don't think they'll finish with a two seed. They will regress, but I think this is a team that could host a first round series. And yeah. I actually think, again, the defense can get even better. They do exert a lot of risk, and they're giving up a lot of perimeter looks that I think they can probably clean up.
I don't think Butler's even played that well yet. He's had moments, right, but I don't think he's played that well yet. Adebayo is averaging 14 and 11, and he is
and the assist,
such
by the
an,
way.
Yeah.
Such an active. How many assists a game? Oh, five assists.
He's averaging 4.6 assists a game at the power forward / center spot.
Just, you know, he's very, very, he's just very active and bouncy and, you know, he's just very involved. I was really kind of surprised. Team USA, we got to watch a lot of the practices. Not all, but we got to watch quite a few scrimmages, and I thank Greg Popovich for that. We got to watch quite a few scrimmages, and I thought Adebayo really stood out in the scrimmages. The first week they had this training camp, and they played against the select team. I thought Trae Young, by the way, stood out in the scrimmages as well, playing for the select team. And they got to their exhibition game, and Adebayo barely got off the bench. I think he was the last guy to get off the bench. He played a handful of minutes, and they cut him after the game. And I remember just thinking, boy, that's a guy that I think could be helpful. But, you know, in international ball, you really need – they pack the paint so tightly, you really need your bigs to be able to shoot, and that's not who he is. But
like Mason Plumlee?
Well, that is a terrific retort. I thought he looked great. That was the first time I'd really seen him play at any, you know, where I could actually watch him in person. And I was just really, really impressed with him. But, look, that's, I'm not saying if they took Adebayo, they would have won the gold. I'm just saying that that would have, before we go, just in general, not one statistic, you know, specific. What's the worry level, Pelton, for you about the 76ers so far? They just came off they had a pretty eventful West Coast trip. Embiid got suspended at the start of it. Simmons got hurt midway through it, hurt his shoulder, then he came back. You know, they had a loss. They ended the trip in Oklahoma City where they lost in overtime the other night. Just in general, overall dipstick, what do you think about the 76ers so far?
I don't think I'm that worried about them, but maybe that's because of the fact that I was a bit of a Sixers skeptic going in terms of, you know, I thought that Milwaukee was going to be the best team in the Eastern Conference and probably by a pretty comfortable margin during the regular season. The RPM projections we did before the year, partially because of the fact that they factor in Ben Simmons as an injury risk due to the time he missed back during what would have been his rookie season, like, you know, had them actually behind Boston in the East. So my expectations for them, particularly in the regular season, weren't that high. And I think we've seen the reasons for that so far. Like, as soon as you take one guy out of that awesome starting lineup that causes a lot of mismatch problems for teams, all of a sudden, their depth, even though Furkan Korkmaz has given them some nice minutes this year in that role, you know, their depth becomes pretty severely compromised. And, you know, even with the addition of Al Horford to give them, you know, some help at center when Joel Embiid is out, well, somebody else has to play power forward or, you know, slide on down the line, and they lose a lot. So I still think this is a team that's going to be by far at their best in the regular season when they can just jack up the minutes of those five guys who are so much better than the rest of their roster.
Arnovitz, I was under the belief that the 76ers would be a top two or so defensive team, potentially one of the most the longest teams in terms of size ever the NBA has ever seen. I thought they were just going to crush people by wrestling them to death on the defensive end. They're 11th in defense so far. And granted, again, it's early, and the difference between 11th and, you know, fifth isn't that huge. It's, you know, it's 10 good days of play, but I'm a little bit worried that they're not more, you know, more dominant defensively.
Yeah, I mean, so much, again, size to me is, I mean, is their greatest virtue there. And I'm willing to give it a little time. Like, I kind of still like the ideal of what I see. I just kind of team defense is a thing that I do think is so dependent on communication and choreography and almost telepathy, right? I mean, great team defense is just a big who knows the tendency of the guard ahead of him guarding the ball screen, so he knows exactly which half step to take before, you know, the guard gets into the lane. Like, I just feel like I'm willing to give the Sixers a pass. I'm not going to apologize for them. You know, by the way, they're eighth in opposing quantified shot probability, so they've still been a good defensive team. They were playing out west, and they had Embiid in and out. Like, I'm willing to say that this is, in terms of sample theater, I still think this is a team that's going to finish squarely in the top eight defensively, probably even higher. Like, I'm just not that concerned. I think they.
I
have
don't
the
think
attributes.
They're a championship team if they finished eighth, though. I think it's got to be.
Well, I'm with you there. And I don't know. If you're asking me to handicap their championship prospects, I'm a little more concerned. But I think this is a very good defensive team that I think at some point in your podcast in the next 5 months that you will be doing a segment talking about. And wow, hasn't the Sixers defense been, you know, the last few weeks we've seen them come into, it's kind of crystallized and it's come into focus. Like,
I
think you'll
Sunday.
See that.
Could be next Sunday. I said it could be.
That's what I'm saying. I kind of like the ideal of what I see. What I see is a team still getting acquainted, and I'm willing to give them a little bit of a pass here. And by the way, they were like 5-0 7 minutes ago and then kind of hit a rough patch. Right. And, you know.
All right. Well, I always enjoy our small sample size theater. Was there any ones that you guys were interested in that we left out?
I thought you were going to do Charlotte? Paul George, Brian.
We did.
Brian, right, I'm sorry.
Right at the top, Mr. Clipper. Were you unsatisfied with your 150-101 victory last night? You want to statistically jump on the pile?
I just want to hear Pelton tell me that this is going to continue. It's going to persist.
Yeah, it's not going to continue. But I'll give you a stat on Paul George. I did some research a few years ago. I think it was maybe, I forget who was having the surgery, maybe Kevin Love when he had that back after that playoff series, but on players coming back from shoulder injuries and whether that affected their shooting the next year. And the takeaway was that there was no impact of it, which is, you know, surprising given obviously the shoulder is very important in shooting. But I think one of the reasons why is something Paul George referenced after Saturday night's game, which is this is the first time in a long time that he's had two healthy shoulders. It's not like an ACL or an Achilles injury where you're healthy and then all of a sudden you're injured. A lot of the time what happens with a shoulder injury is you're playing through this minor thing that gets gradually worse and worse, and then eventually it gets bad enough that you need to have surgery. So you come back and you're not necessarily, even if there is a decline because of the fact that you haven't been shooting for this long period of time, it's kind of offsetting the fact that you weren't 100% before that.
So, Mr. Han, per 36 minutes, Paul George is averaging, and I think this is a, I think this should hold. I think all these will hold. He's averaging 57.3 points per 36 minutes. He's averaging 17 free throws and shooting 1,000%, by the way, on free throws. Averaging 17 free throws per 36 minutes. This is a nice stat, 11 rebounds. So, that might be an MVP season. I'm not an expert, but that might be an MVP season if that holds. All right. Well, thank you guys very much, Kevin and Kevin and Andrew Hahn and Troy back in Bristol, who is making this possible. Have a great week, everybody. We will talk to you soon.